Chapter 39. The pale young gentleman and I stood contemplating one another in Barnard's Inn, until we both burst out laughing. "The idea of its being you," said he. "The idea of its being you," said one. And then we contemplated one another afresh, and laughed again. "Well," said the pale young gentleman, reaching out his hand good-humoredly, "it's all over now, I hope, and it will be magnanimous in you, if you'll forgive me for having knocked you about so." I derived from this speech that Mr. Herbert Pocket, for Herbert was the pale young gentleman's name, still rather confounded his intention with his execution. But I made a modest reply, and we shook hands warmly. "You hadn't come into your good fortune at that time?" said Herbert Pocket. "No," said one. "No," he acquiesced. "I heard it had happened very lately. I was rather on the lookout for good fortune then."
"Indeed?"
"Yes. Miss Havisham had sent for me, to see if she could take a fancy to me. But she couldn't at all events, she didn't." I thought it polite to remark that I was surprised to hear that. "Bad taste," said Herbert, laughing, "but a fact. Yes, she had sent for me on a trial visit, and if I had come out of it successfully, I suppose I should have been provided for. Perhaps I should have been what you may call it to Estella."
"What's that?"
I asked, with sudden gravity. He was arranging his fruit in plates while we talked, which divided his attention, and was the cause of his having made this lapse of a word. "Affianced," he explained, still busy with the fruit.
"Betrothed."
"Engaged."
"What's his name?"
"Any word of that sort."
"How did you bear your disappointment?"
I asked.
"Pooh,"
said he, "I didn't care much for it. She's a Tartar."
"Miss Havisham?"
"I don't say no to that, but I meant Estella. That girl's hard, and haughty and capricious to the last degree, and has been brought up by Miss Havisham, to wreak revenge on all the male sex."
"What relation is she to Miss Havisham?"
"None," said he. "Only adopted."
"Why should she wreak revenge on all the male sex?"
"What revenge?"
"Lord, Mr. Pip," said he. "Don't you know?"
"No," said one.
"Dear me.
It's quite a story, and she'll be saved till dinner time. And now let me take the liberty of asking you a question. How did you come there, that day?"
I told him, and he was attentive until I had finished, and then burst out laughing again, and asked me if I was sore afterwards.
I didn't ask him if he was, for my conviction on that point was perfectly established.
"Mr. Jaggers is your guardian, I understand," he went on.
"Yes. You know he is Miss Havisham's man of business and solicitor, and has her confidence when nobody else has?" This was bringing me, I felt, towards dangerous ground. I answered with a constraint I made, no attempt to disguise, that I had seen Mr. Jaggers in Miss Havisham's house on the very day of our combat, but never at any other time, and that I believed he had no recollection of having ever seen me there. He was so obliging as to suggest my father for your tutor, and he called on my father to propose it. Of course he knew about my father from his connection with Miss Havisham. My father is Miss Havisham's cousin. Not that that implies familiar intercourse between them, for he is a bad courtier, and will not propitiate her. Herbert Pocket had a frank and easy way with him that was very taking. I had never seen anyone then, and I have never seen anyone since, who more strongly expressed to me, in every look and tone, a natural incapacity to do anything secret and mean. There was something wonderfully hopeful about his general air, and something that at the same time whispered to me, he would never be very successful or rich. I don't know how this was. I became imbued with the notion on that first occasion, before we sat down to dinner, but I cannot define by what means. He was still a pale young gentleman, and had a certain conquered languor about him in the midst of his spirits and briskness, that did not seem indicative of natural strength. He had not a handsome face, but it was better than handsome, being extremely amiable and cheerful.
His figure was a little ungainly, as in the days when my knuckles had taken such liberties with it, but it looked as if it would always be light and young. Whether Mr. Trapp's local work would have sat more gracefully on him than on me may be a question, but I am conscious that he carried off his rather old clothes much better than I carried off my new suit. As he was so communicative, I felt that reserve on my part would be a bad return unsuited to our ears. I therefore told him my small story, and laid stress on my being forbidden to inquire who my benefactor was. I further mentioned that as I had been brought up a blacksmith in a country place, and knew very little of the ways of politeness, I would take it as a great kindness in him if he would give me a hint whenever he saw me at a loss or going wrong. "With pleasure," said he, "though I venture to prophesy that he will want very few hints. I dare say we shall be often together, and I should like to banish any needless restraint between us. Will you do me the favor, to begin at once, to call me by my Christian name, Herbert?" I thanked him, and said I would. I informed him in exchange that my Christian name was Philip. "I don't take to Philip," said he, smiling, "for it sounds like a moral boy out of the spelling book, who was so lazy that he fell into a pond, or so fat that he couldn't see out of his eyes, or so avaricious that he locked up his cake till the mice ate it, or so determined to go a bird's nesting that he got himself eaten by bears who lived handy in the neighborhood. I tell you what I should like. We are so harmonious, and you have been a blacksmith, would you mind it?" "I shouldn't mind anything that you propose," I answered, "but I don't understand you. Would you mind Handel for a familiar name? There's a charming piece of music by Handel, called The Harmonious Blacksmith. I should like it very much." "Then, my dear Handel," said he, turning round as the door opened, "here is the dinner, and I must beg of you to take the top of the table, because the dinner is of your providing." This I would not hear of, so he took the top, and I faced him. It was a nice little dinner, seemed to me then, a very Lord Mayor's feast, and it acquired additional relish from being eaten under those independent circumstances, with no old people by, and with London all around us. This again was heightened by a certain gypsy character that set the banquet off, for, while the table was, as Mr. Pumblechook might have said, the lap of luxury being entirely furnished forth from the coffee house, the circumjacent region of sitting room was of a comparatively pastureless and shifty character. Imposing on the waiter the wandering habits of putting the covers on the floor where he fell over them, the melted butter in the armchair, the bread on the bookshelves, the cheese in the coal scuttle, and the boiled fowl into my bed in the next room, where I found much of its parsley and butter in a state of congelation when I retired for the night. All this made the feast delightful, and when the waiter was not there to watch me, my pleasure was without alloy. We had made some progress in the dinner when I reminded Herbert of his promise to tell me about Miss Havisham. "True," he replied. "I'll redeem it at once. Let me introduce the topic, Handel, by mentioning that in London it is not the custom to put the knife in the mouth for fear of accidents, and that, while the fork is reserved for that use, it is not put further in than necessary. It is scarcely worth mentioning, only it's as well to do as other people do. Also, the spoon is not generally used overhand, but under. This has two advantages. You get at your mouth better, which after all is the object, and you save a good deal of the attitude of opening oysters on the part of the right elbow." He offered these friendly suggestions in such a lively way that we both laughed, and I scarcely blushed. "Now," he pursued, "concerning Miss Havisham. Miss Havisham, you must know, was a spoiled child. Her mother died when she was a baby, and her father denied her nothing. Her father was a country gentleman down in your part of the world, and was a brewer. I don't know why it should be a crack thing to be a brewer, but it is indisputable that while you cannot possibly be genteel and bake, you may be as genteel as never was and brew. You see it every day. Yet a gentleman may not keep a public house, may he?" said one. Not on any account, returned Herbert, but a public house may keep a gentleman. Well, Mr. Havisham was very rich and very proud. So was his daughter. Miss Havisham was an only child? I hazarded. Stop a moment, I am coming to that. No, she was not an only child. She had a half-brother. Her father privately married again his cook, I rather think. I thought he was proud, said one. My good handle, so he was. He married his second wife privately, because he was proud, and in course of time she died. When she was dead, I apprehend he first told his daughter what he had done, and then the son became a part of the family, residing in the house you are acquainted with. As the son grew a young man, he turned out riotous, extravagant, undutiful, altogether bad. At last his father disinherited him, but he softened when he was dying, and left him well off, though not nearly so well off as Miss Havisham. Take another glass of wine, and excuse my mentioning that society as a body does not expect one to be so strictly conscientious in emptying one's glass, as to turn it bottom upwards with the rim on one's nose. I had been doing this, in an excess of attention to his recital. I thanked him, and apologized. He said, not at all, and resumed. Miss Havisham was now an heiress, and you may suppose, was looked after as a great match. Her half-brother had now ample means again, but what with debts, and what with new madness, wasted them most fearfully again. There were stronger differences between him and her than there had been between him and his father, and it is suspected that he cherished a deep and mortal grudge against her as having influenced the father's anger. Now, I come to the cruel part of the story merely breaking off, my dear Handel, to remark that a dinner napkin will not go into a tumbler. Why I was trying to pack mine into my tumbler, I am wholly unable to say. I only know that I found myself, with a perseverance worthy of a much better cause, making the most strenuous exertions to compress it within those limits. Again I thanked him and apologized, and again he said in the cheerfulest manner, not at all, I am sure, and resumed. There appeared upon the scene, say at the races, or the public balls, or anywhere else you like, a certain man, who made love to Miss Havisham. I never saw him, for this happened 25 years ago before you and I were, Handel, but I have heard my father mention that he was a showy man, and the kind of man for the purpose, but that he was not to be, without ignorance or prejudice, mistaken for a gentleman, my father most strongly asseverates. Because it is a principle of his that no man who was not a true gentleman at heart ever was, since the world began, a true gentleman in manner. He says, no varnish can hide the grain of the wood, and that the more varnish you put on, the more the grain will express itself. Well, this man pursued Miss Havisham closely, and professed to be devoted to her. I believe she had not shown much susceptibility up to that time. But all the susceptibility she possessed certainly came out then, and she passionately loved him. There is no doubt that she perfectly idolized him. He practiced on her affection in that systematic way that he got great sums of money from her, and he induced her to buy her brother out of a share in the brewery which had been weakly left him by his father at an immense price, on the plea that when he was her husband he must hold and manage it all. Your guardian was not at that time in Miss Havisham's counsels, and she was too haughty, and too much in love, to be advised by anyone. Her relations were poor and scheming, with the exception of my father. He was poor enough, but not time-serving or jealous. The only independent one among them, he warned her that she was doing too much for this man, and was placing herself too unreservedly in his power. She took the first opportunity of angrily ordering my father out of the house, in his presence, and my father has never seen her since. I thought of her having said, Matthew will come and see me at last, when I am laid dead upon that table, and I asked Herbert whether his father was so inveterate against her. "It's not that," said he, "but she charged him, in the presence of her intended husband, with being disappointed in the hope of fawning upon her for his own advancement, and, if he were to go to her now, it would look true even to him, and even to her, to return to the man and make an end of him." The marriage day was fixed, the wedding dresses were bought, the wedding tour was planned out, the wedding guests were invited. The day came, but not the bridegroom. He wrote her a letter, which she received. "I struck in, when she was dressing for her marriage. At 9:20? At the hour and minute," said Herbert, nodding, "at which she afterwards stopped all the clocks. What was in it, further than that it most heartlessly broke the marriage off, I can't tell you, because I don't know. When she recovered from a bad illness that she had, she laid the whole place waste, as you have seen it, and she has never since looked upon the light of day." "Is that all the story?" I asked, after considering it. "All I know of it, and indeed I only know so much, through piecing it out for myself. For my father always avoids it, and, even when Miss Havisham invited me to go there, told me no more of it than it was absolutely requisite I should understand. But I have forgotten one thing. It has been supposed that the man to whom she gave her misplaced confidence acted throughout in concert with her half-brother, that it was a conspiracy between them, and that they..." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.